Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
This morning, we gather in community bringing grief, joy, excitement, weariness, bringing all the stuff of our lives. Whoever you are and whatever you carry into this space this morning, you are welcome here to be you. Today, we're going to talk about the vastness of our universe. You'll be reminded of our tininess in relation to all that has ever been. You'll be reminded of the incredible enormity of all that is. But even in that vastness, even as we are this tiny blip, we are incredibly powerful. We have a vastness inside of us. A being, a living, a force and a power more than we can even understand. Today, as we bring our grief and joy and frustration and hope, we honor the vastness of existence and the vastness of our human living, the force and power in being. And we begin by giving thanks for all of this, all that was and is and ever will be. This morning, as we gather for the first time since the shooting in Florida, we're going to take some time together to honor the grief and fear and resentment and hope and all the different reactions and feelings we are having. From our chalice, we will light 17 candles in silence, each one representing a life stolen on Valentine's Day, each one symbolizing the light, the fire, the love of that person who will be remembered and forever loved. As I light them, I invite you to reflect, pray, meditate, do whatever is right for you in this moment of silence. Please take a deep breath and join me in a spirit of meditation. Let yourself become grounded on your chair, feet on the floor, and breathe deeply. Let yourself feel whatever you are feeling. If you bring a heart filled with heavy sorrow, let your tears come. If you bring a soul filled with righteous anger, let the heat fill you. If you bring a heart filled with hope rising, let the lightness of what's possible fill you. If you bring a soul filled with unanswered longing, let that emptiness be okay here in this moment. There is no right way to be in grief and no timeline for building hope. Just breathe in the cool air of the morning. Just be. Keep breathing deeply. May the families and friends of those killed know love and support in their grief. May all of us who learn and educate and worship and live with that little bit of fear stay strong in our conviction that there is another way. May the leaders of our nation be guided by ethics and courage rather than greed and money. May this be the moment the tide turns in our country and we move toward a greater collective affirmation of the value of all life. May the grief, anger, hope, and longing lead our hearts and souls bravely toward action. So may it be. When I was a kid, I had those glow-in-the-dark stars that you can affix to your ceiling. And I put mine in various constellations instead of randomly. I had Pisces up there and Cassiopeia and the Big Dipper. And when I would turn my light off at night, my own little night sky would shine bright. Though, of course, just outside my windows in New York City, barely a star could be seen given the glow of the city lights. One constellation I didn't have on my ceiling, which is reasonable, was the Southern Cross. In modern times, that constellation can only be seen in the Southern Hemisphere. This grouping of stars that were identified as being in a cross formation used to be visible from Britain until the 4th millennium BCE. The way our Earth turns means that over long periods of time, different stars will rise or not rise in different parts of the horizon. The ancient Greeks could see the Southern Cross, though by 400 CE, that is about 1600 years ago, it was too low for Greeks to observe. I've always wanted to see the sky from the Southern Hemisphere. It seems strange to me to think about seeing a different sky. And it's even more fascinating to me to consider how different cultures have understood constellations. Though our Western culture knows that group of stars by the name Southern Cross, many other cultures identified it and gave it very different meanings. The Maori see in it an anchor weighing down the Milky Way. The Inca call it a stair, and it related to mysticism. The Samoan call it sumu, which means trigger fish. In Tonga, it's a duck flying south. In the East Indies, people see in this grouping manta rays. In Botswana, some people see in this two giraffes. So many different cultures seeing a vast array of images in a few bright dots in the night sky. A few bright dots that may well be dead. We know that stars die, and we know that it takes a long time for the light of stars to travel to us. So many of the stars we see in our night sky are already long gone, but their light is continuing to travel over numbers of miles. It is almost incomprehensible to consider. Proxima Centauri is our closest star, and it's 4 light years away, which translates to nearly 24 trillion miles. A marathon is 26 miles. Many of the stars we see in the sky are 26 trillion miles or more away from us. When we look up from this little Earth of ours, there is a vastness to behold. It's wondrous and awesome in the truest sense of that word, almost unbelievable. And when we think even more deeply about the history of those stars and this universe, it inspires even more awe. I have a cousin who's a scientist, my cousin John. And when I was pregnant with my oldest child, I would ask John to do research and synthesize it for me for like lay people. And I asked him once upon a time to do a little bit of research about us. This was unrelated to my pregnancy, but about us humans, this planet, this universe. And frankly, he knew most of this off the top of his head. And many of you may know this information as well. But the following figures are based on science's best understanding of the existence of everything, based on observable facts. And full credit to my cousin John, some of this phrasing comes directly from him. So leaving aside the why, random chance, God, whatever, the best explanation for how all of this came into being is the Big Bang Theory. And this is the idea that all the energy that we can now observe in the universe was compressed into a single dimensionless point. Before that, my cousin John puts it, we don't even have the technology to make the technology to scientifically address what existed before the Big Bang. Then, for whatever reason, 13.8 billion years ago, that single point starts to expand, expanding and expanding to create the universe. The universe that is still expanding today. Then about 4.5 billion years ago, Earth formed in the Milky Way galaxy. Galaxies vary in age. Some are as old as 3.2 billion years. This image is the Hubble Deep Field, Extreme Deep Field image. This image was compiled from images taken over the course of 10 years with long, long exposure times. So what you're seeing in this image, each of those dots is a galaxy. And some are as old as 13.2 billion years. What that means is that what we're seeing now, as NASA puts it, are galaxies when they were young, small, and growing, often violently as they collided and merged together. The early universe was a time of dramatic birth for galaxies containing brilliant blue stars, extraordinarily brighter than our sun. The light from those past events is just arriving at Earth now, and so the extreme deep field is a time tunnel into the distant past. Now, the other thing to keep in mind about this image from the Hubble telescope is that this is a tiny fraction of the night sky. So Johnny gave me a comparison. If you look up at the night sky and you hold a penny at arm's length, this entire image will fit into Lincoln's eyeball. Like, that's how small it is. And in this picture alone are 5,500 galaxies. To help a viewer better understand the image, NASA goes on to say, "Magnificent spiral galaxies similar in shape to our Milky Way and the neighboring Andromeda galaxy appear in this image, as do the large, fuzzy red galaxies where the formation of new stars has ceased. These red galaxies are the remnants of dramatic collisions between galaxies and are in their declining years. Peppered across the field are tiny, faint, more distant galaxies that were like the seedlings from which today's magnificent galaxies grew. The history of galaxies from soon after the first were born to the great galaxies of today, like our Milky Way, is laid out in this one remarkable image." This one image shows us billions of years of history played out on a scale that is essentially impossible for us to actually fathom. We're literally seeing cosmic, universal history in this picture. And so here we are on this Earth in this galaxy that is about 4.5 billion years old. 3.8 billion years ago, microscopic living cells appear, as the video showed us. 700 million years ago, primitive mammals appear. Animals continue to evolve, and by 65 million years ago, dinosaurs have come and gone. Scientists have dated one hominid fossil to 6 million years ago. Hominids that walked upright date back 2 million years. But Homo sapiens, the modern form of humans, have only been around for 100,000 years. Now, that feels silly to say in a way, only 100,000 years. But when you compare it to the 4.5 billion years since this planet's formation, or the 13.8 billion years since the formation of the universe, it starts to feel like an only. That video actually shows it perfectly, a tiny fraction of a 24-hour period. And anything that shows relative scale and distance, as opposed to age, does this same work of inspiring awe. The sun is 93 million miles away from Earth. In 1977, humans sent up the Voyager 1 probe, which is now about 13 billion miles away from Earth. It is in interstellar space, traveling at 38,000 miles per hour, and even so, it's going to take 74,000 years for that probe to reach the closest star other than the sun. That star is 4.2 light years away. The edge of the universe, as we can observe it, is 45.7 billion light years away. I can't even do the math to calculate for you how many actual miles that translates into. What we see at that edge of the observable universe is light from the afterglow of the Big Bang. The Earth is 7,926 miles in diameter. The moon, only 2,160. About 50 moons would fit inside the Earth. 1 million Earths would fit inside the sun. And our sun is tiny compared to other stars. The star that forms the right arm of Orion the Hunter is so big that 1 billion of our suns would fit inside of it. Here are some more comparisons courtesy of John, so try to imagine this. If our entire solar system were the size of a quarter, if our solar system were the size of a quarter, the galaxy would be as big as the United States, as a comparison. And if our whole galaxy were the size of a quarter, the observable universe would be the size of a spherical New York City. Don't know exactly what that looks like, but you can try to imagine. There are close to 200 billion galaxies in the observable universe, and each of them has 100 to 200 billion stars in them. That means there are more stars in the universe than there are grains of sand on the Earth. I know that's a lot of numbers and comparisons that are kind of hard to even imagine, but the point here is that scientifically, in comparison with the rest of existence, we are, in terms of time and size and space, a speck, a minute part of the history of existence, a tiny blip in the physical universe. We are small, and in some sense, it's fair to say insignificant. If you examine our existence scientifically, we are, to put it in unscientific terms, teeny tiny. And I'll admit, I am as fascinated by watching Neil deGrasse Tyson as I am by anything else, but there are ways in which the scale of the universe and our place in it terrifies me. It's so big. Like, if you really think of it, it is so big. Like, hide under their bed and try to forget that it's that big, big. But the facts are the facts. And anytime we look up at the sky, knowing we are seeing light from stellar bodies that have died millions of years ago, knowing that they are unreachably far away, the facts of our smallness cannot be denied. We might, if we live too deeply into the fact of our smallness, come to feel a sense of despair, or we might come to equate insignificance with meaninglessness, or small with powerless. But these words are not the same. They do not mean the same thing. Carl Sagan has a very famous passage called The Pale Blue Dot, referring to how Earth appears as a small blue dot in some of the earliest pictures of our galaxy, taken by Voyager 1. We have an image of the pale blue dot, hopefully. Okay, so that's our galaxy, and that's us. So in this passage, he says, "Look again at that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines. Every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there, on a mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam." Sagan's poetic words are right. Everyone we have ever known or will ever know, all history as we understand it, has taken place on this pale blue dot. It is a speck of dust in the universe, but it is the speck of dust that we inhabit. And frankly, the vastness of all the rest of it makes our existence that much more miraculous seeming, that much more special. And small can be mighty, tiny can be meaningful. It's up to us to make it so. That is what we do as thoughtful humans. We reject despair. We grasp at happiness and joy. We reject meaningless and make meaning out of things. Peoples across the globe in different cultures, races, religions have stood on beaches, on mountaintops, in treetops, and looked up at the night sky and made meaning there. Told stories, drawn images, developed whole histories based on these enormous stars that we see as pinpricks of light in the dark night. People have always found ways to give meaning to the universe, however little they actually understood it. I first read Paul Tillich's The Courage to Be as an undergraduate. When I got to divinity school, I was in a mandatory first-year seminar, and the professors told us we'd be reading this text and asked if anyone had read it already, and I vigorously nodded my head, eager student that I was. And one of those professors said, "Well, do you have anything to share about it?" And I said, "It's the reason I'm here." That's all I said. But that book, it's a compilation of lectures published in 1952, and it's dense, but it's filled with these nuggets of wisdom that were and remain inspiring for me. Now, Tillich himself was a Christian, and if you read his works, God is all over them. And later this spring, we're going to do a whole service around different theologies, and we'll talk about his vision of the divine, among others. But the first thing that grabbed me way back then was not anything to do with a notion of God, but this concept of being with a capital B and non-being. Tillich's idea here is that big B being also encompasses non-being. That the thing that causes us humans anxiety and fear is the threat of our non-being, in other words, our actual deaths. But also there's this anxiety of guilt and condemnation and this anxiety of meaninglessness and emptiness. We feel the fear of non-being when we confront the fact of our finitude, the potential for our moral failings, and the possibility that our lives are meaningless. But we feel all of that as part of being. Being itself includes all of those threats to being, and being overcomes them. The power of being, our participation in the perpetuation of life, is the courage to be. Our participation in creation and living is in itself a force of being and is an act of courage. He refers to it as self-affirming oneself. Living, being, as a limited and erring human in this world that so often breeds despair, living and being is an act of courage that subsumes that fear. It is in this act of self-affirmation through courageous living that we find meaning and purpose, that we find what it actually means to be. Last week brought yet another tragedy to our nation. 17 people shot and killed, and it seemed that we would enter the cycle we all know too well of folks throwing up their hands and claiming nothing can be done, and we all mourn and then go back to the same BS of sending our kids to school unsure if they will make it home. But as many have pointed out in the last week and a half, something is different. Students who survived this massacre are rising up. Marches, walkouts, postcards. Companies are now ditching their partnerships with the NRA. There's something different happening this time. These kids who have witnessed something horrible, who have spent time believing they would die, spent time deeply in the threat of non-being, are, not in spite of it, but because of it, radically affirming their living and the right to living that all of us share. They are displaying an incredible courage in the face of incredible threat, because quite literally that threat continues as these students are attacked on social media and death threats are made against them. We humans are capable of a great deal of evil. Carl Sagan reminds us of that in his text, at one point referencing the rivers of blood spilled by all those generals and emperors so that in glory and triumph they could become the momentary masters of a fraction of a dot. The endless cruelties visited by the inhabitants of one corner of this pixel on the scarcely distinguishable inhabitants of some other corner. How frequent their misunderstandings, how eager they are to kill one another, how fervent their hatreds. He writes. We are capable of such awful things. And the world with all its horrors and indeed all its vastness can seem so hard at times. And yet there is this courage to be, this courage to keep living, righteously, even in the face of all that threat of non-being. And we see this courage every day, though we may not always frame it that way. The courage to be in the face of all of this looks like those students from Marjory Stoneman Douglas School. It looks like the families and teachers and students planning to walk out and march regardless of the consequences. It looks like the founders and activists and supporters of Black Lives Matter. It looks like immigration activists and feminists and anyone and everyone around the world simply getting up each day and living as best and as well and as gently and as kindly as they can. It looks like each of us trying day in and day out to become the best version of ourselves and to encourage others to do the same. It looks like each of us being willing to look at ourselves and our world honestly, to see where we fall short, to feel that anxiety, and then say, this is all part of my living, and my living, the power of my being, the courage I have to be is greater than all of that. I had those glow-in-the-dark stars because I always loved the night sky, and so it's maybe no surprise that I love a particular poem by Walt Whitman. It's called On the Beach at Night, and I would like to read it to you. Whitman writes, "On the beach at night stands a child with her father, watching the east, the autumn sky, up through the darkness while ravening clouds, the burial clouds, in black masses spreading, lower sullen and fast athwart and down the sky. Amid a transparent, clear belt of ether yet left in the east, ascends large and calm the Lord star Jupiter. And right at hand, only a very little above, swim the delicate sisters, the Pleiades. From the beach, the child holding the hand of her father, those burial clouds that lower victorious, soon to devour all, watching, silently weeps. Weep not, child, weep not, my darling. With these kisses, let me remove your tears. The ravening clouds shall not long be victorious. They shall not long possess the sky. They devour the stars only in apparition. Jupiter shall emerge. Be patient. Watch again another night. The Pleiades shall emerge. They are immortal. All those stars, both silvery and golden, shall shine out again. The great stars and the little ones shall shine out again. They endure. The vast and immortal suns and the long enduring pensive moons shall again shine. Then, dearest child, mournest thou only for Jupiter? Considerest thou alone the burial of the stars? Something there is, with my lips soothing thee, adding, I whisper, I give thee the first suggestion, the problem and indirection. Something there is more immortal even than the stars. Many the burials, many the days and nights passing away. Something that shall endure longer even than lustrous Jupiter, longer than the sun or any revolving satellite, or the radiant sisters, the Pleiades." That image of a girl and her father standing on the beach, and she weeps in fear of the clouds on the horizon. She fears the violent clouds will never go away and the sun will never return. And her father tries to soothe her. We're left to assume it did not soothe her, and she continues to weep, so he tries again, assuring her that there is something more permanent than even these stars and moons and suns. There's something that survives long after individual suns and moons disappear, and we know now that they do disappear. Whitman doesn't name that something, maybe part of why I love this poem. He doesn't tell us that that something that endures is God or love or being. He leaves that for us, an open door, saying yes. Sometimes looking at the night sky and watching those faraway stars is frightening. Sometimes watching clouds roll in for a storm or sitting inside watching snow swirl in a blizzard around us is terrifying. Sometimes the very act of living feels terrifying. Sometimes things happen that are gut-wrenching, that leave us soul grieving for what humanity can do. Sometimes we want to weep. And yet there is more than these fears. There is more in our lives than weeping. Something there is more immortal even than the stars. And maybe you believe that's love or God or both. Certainly, science teaches us that energy can never be destroyed. It just shifts its state. All the energy that exists in the universe that was in that dense single point that started expanding. And whatever the future holds, that energy will continue to exist. And there's something comforting in knowing that. As far as we know, there's no real end, only change. John shared one last amazing comparison with me. If you unravel all the DNA molecules in all the cells, in all the humans on Earth, and place them end to end in one big thread, it would wrap around the circumference of the Milky Way galaxy about 100 times. And I love this one, as silly as it is in some ways, more than any other, because what this says to me is that however small we are complex, intricate beings. The very building blocks of our beings are vast in their way. It took billions of years for us to develop out of that single point, and we owe something to those billions of years. We are the result of so much history, the result of so much development, that we must take seriously the time and space we have, the abilities and impacts we have. We must not be overcome by the ravening clouds or the vastness of space. We have to live into our smallness and our power and pull the most meaning we can out of our lives. And this is what religion, in its best sense, calls us to. Make meaning, live meaningfully. Just as millennia of people have taken time to give names to stars and create whole mythologies around them, so too we are called to name and explore and define and make sense of our own lives. We are asked to learn from our mistakes, to behave better in the world, to recognize that although we are small in the universe here on our pale blue dot, we are incredibly powerful. We know that we humans are powerful when it comes to each other and to this world. We know that we can make decisions about how we're going to treat each other, treat ourselves, treat this earth. Decisions that will affect our friends and family and environment. This may be just a pale blue dot. We may just be a small blip in the history of the universe. But this is the portion we know. This is the blue dot we know. And we must do better by each other and by it if we want any hope of humanity continuing to exist. Aware of our smallness and our greatness, we are called to live with a deep love for all that brought us to this point, the billions of years of which we are one product. To live with love for being, for existence, for all of this, we must live with intention, live purposefully looking for meaning, purposefully making meaning, purposely doing our best in every moment to honor all that is our lives. Allowing our courage to be to embrace and overcome the fear and anxiety, causing even the most despairing moments to be outshined by our love. May we continue to live with courage, embracing our insignificance but never forgetting that our lives are filled with meaning, embracing our smallness but never forgetting our vastness, embracing our fears but never forgetting our power. So may it be.